In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
I'm going to speak for about 35, 40 minutes with some thoughts on the article by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, The Grid of History, Cowboys and Indians, which was originally in the Monthly Review, July, August 2003. And then we'll take a break. Those of you in the People's History Group may recall that we discussed Dunbar Ortiz's arguments when we were examining People's History of the United States. However, because of the presence of new members and a different format, and the critical arguments that she makes on U.S. imperialism, it seems that they compel us to revisit her reasoning. I will try to focus my comments on her comments and on other scholarship on U.S. colonial history in roughly the first century of U.S. history. Right from the beginning, Dunbar Ortiz makes it clear that she has no patience with people like Senator Robert Byrd and others who lament about the state of our country because of the invasion of Iraq. That is, those who ignore the long history of U.S. aggression that actually began with the founding of the nation in 1776. She's even critical of anti-imperialists, the anti-imperialists who have been making the same point as Byrd, who somehow erase U.S. history in their critiques of Bush's foreign policy. Continuity is hidden, and a small departure is exaggerated that allows the present regime, that is the Bush regime, to be seen as dramatically different than others in its conduct of U.S. foreign policy. She argues that an accurate understanding of U.S. history, therefore, must confront what she calls the origins of white supremacy, as it has been experienced and institutionalized and denied. A force that is rooted in prior colonizing ventures of Christian crusades into Muslim-controlled areas and to the Calvinist Protestant colonization of Ireland. That is, these two historical events are the colonial models for the Western Hemisphere and the two strands that will come together and merge in the makeup of the United States. They serve as the foundations for an understanding of the virulent racism that is the basis for the genocidal assault on the original Americans by Europeans. I will stress one aspect of her critique of U.S. imperialism and discuss it in light of other supporting scholarship, emphasizing the colonial and U.S. crusade to destroy the first Americans. Dunbar Ortiz claims that it is the origin story of the Ulster Scots Calvinists who settled and colonized Northern Ireland and who were the majority of those who settled the western lands along the Appalachian and Allegheny Mountains that became the origin story of the United States. This story is essentially about pilgrims, settlers, doing God's will, and forging the promised land while being surrounded by savages. The first savages being the Irish in Ulster, and then Native Americans in North America. It is these Calvinist Protestants, it is their sacrifice and bloodshed that make them supposedly the true inheritors of the land. Not first Americans, not African slaves, not immigrants from other regions of the world. This sacrifice and bloodshed is essential to understanding what Dunbar-Ortiz calls the ideology of white supremacy, an ideology that helped to neutralize and undermine the class antagonisms in the United States of the landless against the landed. She asked us to understand the intimate and essential link between the English conquest of Northern Ireland in the early 1600s and similar policies aimed at exterminating Indians here in North America that was foreshadowed by the English colonization of Northern Ireland. The Calvinist Protestants were assured by religious leaders that they had been chosen by God for salvation and the title to the Irish lands. The native and papist Irish were clearly not destined for salvation. This process was repeated in the United States against Native Americans. According to Dunbar-Ortiz, therefore, the founding of the United States is intimately tied to this white supremacist, settler colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state. Thomas Jefferson spoke about the U.S. as an empire for liberty, and Andrew Jackson coined the phrase extending the area of freedom to describe the process by which slavery was introduced into Texas in violation of Mexican laws, to be quickly followed by a slaveholder's rebellion and U.S. annexation. The term freedom, in her view, is a code word or code term or euphemism for the continental and worldwide expansion of the world's leading slave power. Before becoming president in 1828, Andrew Jackson gained his early fame as a military leader who led wars against Indians in the southeastern United States. As president, he later was responsible for the forced march expulsion of first Americans from east of the Mississippi to the Oklahoma Territory, the infamous Trail of Tears that led to the death of thousands of Native Americans. Dunbar-Ortiz names white supremacy as the working rationalization and ideology of English theft of Native American lands, and especially the justification for slavery. She also unsettles us quite a bit with her claim that this white supremacist U.S. origin myth is itself closely tied to the parallel Afrikaner origin myth in South Africa and apartheid. When one considers the moral and political lessons we all learned about the glorious founding of the United States in our schools, how many of us here can point to even one that compared our history to that of South Africa? White supremacy is not only the core premise of U.S. foreign policies from the origins to the present. This supremacy and imperialism are also inseparable from the content of this origin story and the definition of patriotism today. It began before the official founding of the nation and was not an accident or aberration in the progression of democracy. Her thesis, therefore, is that the United States was fundamentally imperialist and racist from the beginning, and imperialism was not a divergence from a well-intentioned path. We didn't just stray from wonderful premises and values. Those premises and values were profoundly and fundamentally flawed from the beginning. Many citizens here seem to be shocked when they discover that the United States has had an imperial past from the founding and has shown expansionist tendencies since colonial days. Dunbar-Ortiz even argues that our war for independence, our American Revolution, was itself a war for expansion, and Thomas Jefferson nursed even grander plans for empire. If we are to understand the recent history of the U.S. empire, therefore, we must understand its earliest roots and confront its most fundamental conflict, the 250-plus-year war against first Americans by Europeans and Euro-Americans. It was during the era of Jackson's presidency that the unique U.S. origin myth was created. with James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohegans as the official story. Cooper was the great hero of Walt Whitman, who sang the song of manhood and the American super race through empire. Many who love Whitman's poetry do not know that he enthusiastically supported the war against Mexico, a conflict that followed the already established U.S. origin myth that had frontier settlers replacing the native peoples with a white supremacist ideology that formed the core of U.S. policies from its origins to the present. These colonial and U.S. policies came together in one long conflict between Europeans and Indians that began with the Pequod War in 1637 in what is now Massachusetts and Connecticut, both states being named after first American nations. It ended some 250 years later in 1890 at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, when hundreds of unarmed Lakota Sioux, mostly women, children, and old men, were massacred. Among the prominent citizens supporting and even advocating genocide against first Americans in the U.S. was none other than L. Frank Baum, the author of the much-beloved Wizard of Oz, who was editor of the Aberdeen Pioneer in South Dakota at the time of Wounded Knee. Before the massacre, he stated, and I quote, "The nobility of the redskin is extinguished, and what few are left are a pack of whining curs who lick the hand that smites them. The whites, by law of conquest, by civilization, are masters of the American continent, and the best safety of the frontier settlements will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians." After the massacre at Wounded Knee, Baum wrote that we had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up and wipe out these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth. Where was Dorothy when the Lakota Sioux needed her? When I read this about L. Frank Baum, who grew up not far from where I used to live in upstate New York, in Chittenango, New York, near Syracuse, blew my mind. It's still a wonderful story, though, and movie.
Where did you find that?
I'll give you the source. When we examine actual, as opposed to fantastical, U.S. history, therefore, we are compelled to agree with historian Howard Zinn that its record of expansion is so long and odious that if you knew it, you could not possibly talk about kindly motives. Only a lack of that history would allow people to believe that American power is going to be used for good. That history goes back to the extermination of Indian tribes. On October 12, 1992, the 500th commemoration of Columbus's invasion of the Americas, Russell Means of the American Indian Movement seconded Zinn's and Dunbar Ortiz's assessment of U.S. First American history. He stated, "All my life, I've had to listen to rhetoric about the U.S. being a model of freedom and democracy, the most unique, enlightened, and humanitarian country in history, a nation of laws that, unlike others, has never pursued policies of conquerors and aggressors. It's the official truth taught to school children, and it's the line peddled to the general public. The whole thing's a lie," he said, "and it always has been. Leaving aside the obvious points which could be raised to dispute by blacks and Chicanos and Asian immigrants right here in North America, not to mention Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Hawaiians, Filipinos, Vietnamese, Cubans, and Iraqis, there's a little matter of genocide that's got to be taken into account right here at home. I'm talking about the genocide that has been perpetrated against American Indians that began the instant the first of Europe's both peoples washed up on the beach of Turtle Island. Against Indians, there's not a law the U.S. hasn't broken, not a crime against humanity it hasn't committed, and it's still going on." Other scholars have also documented Dunbar Ortiz's arguments about empire and white supremacy. Nathan Huggins, for example, suggests that his American historian colleagues have conspired with the founding fathers to create a nationalist history bound to the founders' ideals rather than their reality. The end result is that the holy nation thus acquired a holy history. A conspiracy of myth, history, and chauvinism served to create an ideology as the dominant history motif against which all history would emanate. Huggins asserts that the essential American story has been based on a belief in the fulfillment over time of the enduring principles of the founding fathers. Events or institutions that seem to contradict these principles, slavery or imperialism, for example, have been understood as aberrations, as historical accidents. The story we learned is that the U.S. has been good from the beginning, despite the contradictions that have not been allowed to undermine the basic fine intentions of our founding or our origins. In a very powerful book entitled Facing West, The Metaphysics of Indian Hating and Empire Building, the historian Richard Drinnen develops his theme of Indian hating, what he calls the actual history of white hostility that for four centuries had exterminated savages who stood in the path of Anglo-American expansion. He asserts that the massacres in Vietnam's Indian country in the 1960s were consistent with those of Filipinos at the turn of the century and with those of Indians on the continent earlier, such as at Wounded Knee. He continues, "But the massacres at My Lai and all the forgotten My Keys in Vietnam had a basic continuity with those of Filipinos at the turn of the century and of Native Americans on the mainland earlier, all the Wounded Knees and Sand Creeks. That linkage of atrocities over time and space reveals underlying themes and fundamental patterns of the national history that lawmakers, generals, and so many of their compatriots were eager to forget." Drinnen asserts that dispossession of first Americans was the defining and enabling experience of the Republic. On one side were the children of light, order, philanthropy, freedom, Americanization, modernization, forced urbanization. On the other side were the children of darkness, savages who stood in the way of the redemption and rationalization of the West. V.J. Kiernan, in his book, America, the New Imperialism, argues that the U.S. was never an Eden of primal innocence. During the colonial period, rich merchants and shipowners protected by the British flag imported molasses from the West Indies that was made into rum. The profits were then used to purchase slaves in Africa. This triangular relationship linked New as well as Old England with West Indian slavery from the 1640s and was deeply entrenched by the time the United States was founded in 1776. An historical event that he argues was essentially built upon exploitation and slaving. So expansion was on the U.S. menu from the founding, and some even wanted to expand into South America. One political figure wrote in 1828, for example, that the emancipation of Spanish America would form a new era in our political existence, would elevate us from the rank of a second to that of a first power, and would place us at the head of one of the great divisions into which the Christian world would be thrown by the effect of this immense revolution. At the time of the War of Independence in 1770s, however, expansion in the North was blocked by the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, whom the 19th century U.S. anthropologist Lewis Henry Morgan called a vigorous and intelligent people. They have illustrated some of the highest virtues of mankind in their relations with each other. Some nations within that confederacy sided with the British during the War of Independence, and reprisals followed against the Cayuga, for example, who made their home in and around what was my former home of Ithaca in central New York State. At that time, General George Washington, the father of our country, ordered General Sullivan to destroy all the Iroquois villages in what is now the Finger Lakes region of New York State, especially along Cayuga and Seneca Lakes. These search and destroy missions were brutally carried out, devastating what Morgan called the North American Indians' finest civilization north of Mexico. The search and destroy campaign of the 1770s and 1780s was continued by the greatest Indian killer in U.S. history, Andrew Jackson, who became president in 1828. Woodrow Wilson, himself an imperialist and racist of the first rank, stated that Jackson's notion of Indians was frankly that of the frontier soldier. They had no right in his eyes, Wilson said, to stand in the way of the white man. Despite loud protests from missionaries who worked and lived among what were called the civilized tribes, the Cherokee, for example, in 1830, Jackson pushed through the Indian Removal Bill that authorized him to transport any Indians beyond the Mississippi. Kiernan calls this one of the blackest chapters in American history, marked by suffering akin to those of the Middle Passage for slaves. Thousands of Cherokee died on that trail of tears. In a provocative thesis that lends support to Dunbar Ortiz's assertion that white supremacy and genocide were essential to the founding of the U.S., the social theorist and writer Professor Joel Covell argues that the assault on first Americans came because they were the object of the first Red Scare and the primal communist of American history. He says that in U.S. history to the present, millions of innocents lie dead, whole societies have been laid to waste, a vigorous labor movement has been castrated, and the political culture of the U.S. has been frozen in a retrograde position, all for the sake of overcoming communism. Thus, attacks on Reds or communists with a small c are critical elements, in his view, in the rise of empire here over the past 230 years, and anti-communism has been essential to consolidate this movement. Covell reminds us that when English colonists arrived here, first Americans were already here. This land was their land. Everything, the beaches where Euro-Americans now vacation, the eastern forests, the southern swamps, the endless plains, the high mounts, the blazing desert, and the green Pacific coastlands, every inch was theirs. Therefore, he argues that in order to take that land and destroy that base, the trail of repression that ended as anti-communism began as Indian hating. The first Red Scare targeted the first communists, and anti-communist wars against first Americans were ultimately about suppressing opposition to capitalist rule, starting in 1637 with the Pequod War. The English colonists who came had a philosophical and religious commitment to private property and ownership. They found themselves in conflict with first Americans, whose notions of ownership were radically different from European notions. First Americans had a different mode of production, one involving collective ownership rather than individual ownership of productive property. The Indians rejected the conception that an individual could grow rich by exploiting the forced labor of others, and the idea of treating things as commodities that could be exchanged for money was profoundly alien to them. Covell, along with scholars Ward Churchill, Richard Drinnen, and Richard Slotkin, asserts that we cannot understand the fundamental historical genesis and unfolding of U.S. history, especially the nature of empire and violence, without confronting, in the words of Herman Melville, the Indian hating that became so enduring a feature of the American cultural landscape. Covell goes on, "The harsh truth is this, that to build the city upon the hill, and later to extend this into liberal society, the native had to be kept locked into the historical position of bestiality and ultimately assaulted and destroyed." Richard Slotkin writes that for Cotton Mather and other influential Puritan ministers of the colonial period, "The Indian Wars are one phase of the control war between Satan and Christ. In the strategy of that war, Indian attacks, the visitation of specters, devils, and witches in 1692, and the growth of heretical sects on the frontier are related phenomena, are pieces in Satan's grand design of conquest. Although the founding fathers were not caught up with the devil as the Puritans of a century before, they still held similarly ethnocentric and white supremacist views of first Americans. For example, in a letter Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The English have seduced the greater part of the tribes within our neighbor to take up the hatchet against us, and the cruel massacres they have committed on the women and children of our frontiers taken by surprise will oblige us now to pursue them to extermination or drive them to new seats beyond our reach." It is a shocking but profound realization, Slotkin writes, that this frankly genocidal proposition comes from the greatest and most humane mind of early America. He states that between Indian hunting and empire building, a whole society had to grow capable of being directed to the hunt. Regardless of the individual merits of any white or Indian, he argues that all here were caught up in a fundamentally unjust relationship. The settlers were there to expropriate the indigenous people and build white society on the ruins of Indian society. From this foundational relationship and injustice have been built all subsequent U.S. history and imperialism, renewed, regenerated generation after generation in Mexico, Cuba, the Philippines, Central and South America, Vietnam, Iraq. Unless we understand the genesis and ground rules of this history, therefore, we cannot make sense of the contemporary U.S. empire. According to Covell, the author, Herman Melville brilliantly represented this Indian-hating society in his novel Moby Dick as the ship Pequod. He states, "It is quite impossible to imagine its narrative," remember the narrative, "a mad sea captain leading a motley crew on a doomed chase of vengeance across the world's oceans coming from another nation. Moby Dick's excesses are the excesses of America, and the peculiar gesture of American anti-communism is prefigured in Melville's portrayal of the persecutory mind of Ahab." I doubt if any of us got that analysis in high school when we read Moby Dick. Indian hating in U.S. history through the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890 was taught to us in our schools as Indian removal, not what it truly was, a genocidal attack on indigenous people who had a sacred connection to nature and the land, who were destroyed by Christians who claimed to speak for God and noble spiritual values. The fundamental beliefs of Christianity, therefore, not just their more militant Puritan expression, are central to this tragedy and to the subsequent development of U.S. imperialism and must be part of any critical understanding of U.S. history. The white supremacist views of Indians were put forth by eminent historians who referred to native territories as empty space, wilderness, vast chaos, unopened land, and virgin land. Samuel Eliot Morrison of Harvard, arguably the most famous U.S. historian of the first half of the 20th century and the preeminent biographer of Christopher Columbus, dismissed Indians as, quote, "pagans expecting short and brutish lives, void of any hope for the future. They were Stone Age savages." The imperial assault came despite a social life, for example, among Eastern Indians that attracted the admiration of some European and U.S. observers. Scholars point out that the Iroquois Confederacy was directly or indirectly responsible for the public meeting tradition, free speech, democracy, and all those things which got attached to the Bill of Rights. The League influenced the Founding Fathers and the U.S. Constitution, for example, especially in the Articles of Confederation. But Iroquois social life was too critical or too radical even for the most advanced framers of the Constitution. We did not have women's suffrage federally until 1920, though it was fundamental to Iroquois government. We still have the capital punishment that the Iroquois abolished, and concern for child welfare that was prominent among the Iroquois did not truly arise until the 20th century in the United States. When one looks honestly and objectively at U.S. history and imperialism, therefore, it seems to me that it's clear that the age-old assertions about who is barbaric and who is civilized must be stood on their head. As Howard Zinn reminds us, the Eurocentric view of history that we learned in our schools is quite simply the colonizer's model of the world. This model is built upon the foundation of white supremacy that has formed the core of U.S. foreign relations from the founding to the present, beginning with first American nations. White supremacy and imperialism, therefore, are inseparable from this origin story and the definition of patriotism. They are the very lifeblood of the U.S. state. In Zinn's People's History, as all you students remember from last year, we learned that the U.S.-Mexican War was also an example of manifest destiny and imperialism. Many here in the U.S. believe the war was for democracy and racial superiority, even though at the time the U.S. was a slave society and Texas would end up as a slave state, which certainly can't be reconciled with democracy. Political leaders believed that we were following God's designs and used religious ideas to justify this imperialist and racist war of aggression, that the white Anglo-Saxon race was destined to govern the inferior. Many white Americans still see themselves in the superior light as the chosen people, but clearly can't use the same blatant language that people used in the 1840s. The abolitionists at that time protested the war because it was waged solely for the horrible purpose of extending and perpetuating slavery throughout Mexico, which of course was the real reason. But as with all wars, it had to be given a patriotic, godlike gloss to appeal to the masses. One of the foremost abolitionists of that time, Henry David Thoreau, bitterly opposed the Mexican War, as reflected in his famous essay on civil disobedience. Another leading abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, argued that this was a war of aggression, of invasion, of conquest, and even urged the defeat of U.S. forces in the war. Can one imagine any major U.S. figure arguing such a position today about Iraq, or even arguing such a position about Vietnam 30 years ago? The war was also opposed by Frederick Douglass, the great African-American abolitionist, who called it a disgraceful, cruel, and iniquitous conflict. The manifest destiny ideology that shaped the war with Mexico would emerge again some 60 years later during the imperial assault on the Filipino people, when senators stated that the U.S. should, quote, not renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustee under God of the civilizing of the world. Public officials today articulate a similar imperial arrogance, arguing that, as with the Mexican War, God is on our side. During the debate over Hawaii in the late 19th century, however, one senator challenged the basis of manifest destiny in forceful terms, a manifest destiny that has shaped colonial and U.S. imperial actions toward other people since the Pequot War. He stated, throughout all recorded time, manifest destiny has been the murderer of men. It has committed more crimes, done more to oppress and wrong the inhabitants of the world than any other tribute. Manifest destiny has caused the strong to rob the weak and has reduced the weak to slavery. Manifest destiny is simply the cry of the strong in justification of their plunder of the weak. During all your years of schooling, did a single teacher dare to raise such a critique of U.S. actions in the world? Do we recall a single mass media commentator stating such a view? In order to move towards such a critique, therefore, it seems we have to engage in a mental cleaning process that will afford us the opportunity of challenging the Orwellian conditioning about imperialism that we received from education and the mass media. In this deconditioning process, we might embrace the insights of social theorist and writer Harry Magdoff, who is quoted at the end of Dunbar Ortiz's article. Citizens of an imperialist country who wish to understand imperialism must first emancipate themselves from the seemingly endless web of threads that bind them emotionally and intellectually to the imperialist condition. Let's take a break. Relax a bit, take 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll come back, and then we'll spend the rest of the time in discussion. As I recall, the citation about L. Frank Baum was in a book by David Stannard called American Holocaust, a marvelous book. One thing before we begin discussion, I want to try to really go at her arguments, the strengths and weaknesses, rather than, you know, what do we do about all this? Well, we can't do anything about undoing what happened centuries ago. We try to understand it. So let's open it up.
I was wondering about how her thesis about racism and so on, the centrality of religion, Protestantism, squared with the Marxist explanations. I mean, you know, it seems nothing about economics here. I mean, one could say that, sure, what she claims is a factor in U.S. imperialism, but to say that's the only factor and everything reduces to it seems extreme.
I would agree with you. I mean, that she's emphasizing, because in some of her other writings, of course, she talks about the class nature of American capitalism and exploitation. She had another piece in some, maybe in a few years ago, where she was countering what I guess she might call a simplistic class analysis based on economics, which really, she thought, couldn't explain the kinds of virulent hatred that she saw. She's from a Native American, Okie, as she calls herself, background. White folks who, many who then ended up in California, you know, the Grapes of Wrath people. And I think that this may follow that to try and balance the heavy analysis on economics that sometimes, she argued, can let white working people off the hook. I mean, we're not born as racists, we're not born to hate people, but it's clear that even folks who are incredibly oppressed in this society pick up the banner and engaged in, you know, Indian hating Mexicans, etc. I mean, that is an aspect that's not emphasized here, Charles, so that's a good point.
Hi. I agree with the previous gentleman's concept, because I think her definition is very narrow of what we're seeing, that the concept of social Darwinism, to me, applies much more to the situation than just simple racism. That the differentiation between colonialism and imperialism is something I've always struggled with precisely. But when I think of world history and apply what her views are, it doesn't fit the puzzle. For instance, Sparta against the Phoenicians, China against Vietnam, the Ottoman Empire, the Aztecs, the Zulus, and Japan into Manchuria, all these things simply don't fit her analysis. And I would argue that it's much more illogical to think of social Darwinism, of the strong against the weak, as you referred to in your comments, than it would be to have a simple racist approach to it, which of course is a major fundamental aspect. But to me, it's a rich, poor, have-not social Darwinist approach and not primarily a racist approach.
Recall, though, that she's emphasizing here particularly, I mean, she talks about the roots in terms of what the British did to the Irish first, that's sort of the trial for what later happened in the U.S. Many of the things that the English did in Irish villages and to Irish lands, they later did to American Indians. But that the approach here and the fundamental focus is on what we would call American or U.S. history in terms of looking at all these other empires, some of which, you know, in terms of some of those wars that I remember vaguely from my history classes a long time ago, that I couldn't certainly argue either way at this point. But the focus, I think she's trying to keep it, is to what became the United States, what actually happened in what is now the continental United States, around the issues, quote-unquote, of cowboys and Indians, around the issue of Indian hating, the Protestants coming to the United States, especially in New England, and continuing from Plymouth Rock all the way here to the West Coast with the Chumash, whether her thesis would hold up with all these other empires and social Darwinists, the powerful literally eating up the weak.
The Civil War.
I mean, our Civil War.
American Civil War.
but certainly couldn't make the argument that the Civil War in the United States wasn't around what Du Bois called the fundamental conflict in U.S. history, the issue of color, of chattel slavery. I mean, there was ultimately no way that that was going to be settled, I would argue, without bloodshed. I mean, there was no way that it was going to be sort of compromised. Even though Lincoln, if the South had not seceded, hadn't had the shot at Fort Sumter, Lincoln was prepared to literally have the country be half slave and half free.
Well, the power of racism, not as we understand it today, but as it must be understood in those days, was undeniable. People of the white people really separated themselves from the Indians, and they were considered unsalvageable until they were even converted to Christianity. And even that wasn't good enough, as we can have plainly seen throughout history. The idea, well, what you discovered, the purity of blood, the limpieza de sangre of the Spanish Inquisition was new to me. The idea that they would hound people to find out if they were really Christian, and if they hadn't really firmly converted to Christianity, they were burned at the stake. They were considered to be impure of blood. It's very, very interesting insight, and this attitude could easily have just permeated all of Christianity. Very easy, and that could have been the very conduit of the idea of race as being something really indelible and unchangeable. In our own country, I think that's incredibly interesting. That's the one thing that really stopped me right there. I had to read that over and over again, you know. Because I'm Jewish, I always thought it was simply a matter of difference in belief, but it wasn't. It really was blood. And I think that percolated right straight through. It's demonstrated even in the comments in the British invasion of the Irish. They were considered subhuman. And the social Darwinism, sure. Darwin's idea of the descent of man, you know, it was very convenient to have one other people descended a little bit further down than you. I think that's a very strong influence.
By the way, one of the graphic, I think a powerful graphic representation of the racism that she discusses in this book in terms of the attitude of whites who happen to be Christians toward indigenous peoples is in the powerful Australian film Rabbit Proof Fence. It's about a different society. And the kinds of things that were done in Australia, actually up to 1970, by the way, in terms of taking indigenous children away from their families, putting them in boarding schools, etc., of course, was done here in the United States to children of various Indian nations. You know, without laying out the text for you, because I think you should see it yourself, but it's a true story in terms of these young people who are in one of these boarding schools and what they do. So, and it was at such a virulent depth that in terms of past centuries, I learned about this. You go to schools, you learn about the pilgrims, you learn about the first Thanksgiving, etc., etc., etc. Who heard about Wounded Knee, Sand Creek? Charles, you were.
I think we're missing something if we overlook her paragraph here where she says, going into the Moorish aspect of this, it was claimed by a contemporary that when the Christians went to war against the Moors, it was neither because of the law of Mohammed nor because of the sect that they hold to, but because of the lands they occupied and for this reason alone. So I don't think she's putting that out there as a substitute. What she's saying is, in my reading of it, is that once you, as an elite, make a determination that you want the resources of a less powerful group, then how do you justify that? Well, the first, you have to justify it in some way in order to enlist the laborers who are going to go out and make this happen for you. And the way you do that is by, and then she goes into this long explanation of the sanctity of blood, how there are these people who are not part of the noble class, but because they were, quote, original Christians, they could be held to be superior to the Moors, and therefore superior means you're more entitled, right? More entitled means they're lesser human. Lesser human means justification of the taking. And I see that aspect repeated over and over again throughout imperial takings throughout history, regardless of whether it's the Persians and the Greeks or, you know, the Romans and anybody else. It's always like our civilization is better. We're more enlightened. We're more blessed by God. We're superior. It's our manifest duty to go out and share the great benefits of our civilization by crushing these other people and taking their land and making them our slaves, and then they'll learn how to be us. I just see that kind of same thing repeated over and over again to this very present day in Iraq. I don't, and the way that she boiled the whole thing down in a few pages is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Her comment, by the way, I'm reading this because this is from the Monthly Review, where she says, "It is said that Columbus watched the people being loaded onto ships for deportation as he set sail in 1492. We do know historically that at least in the same week, the ships who were carrying Jews who had been expelled from Spain and Muslims were leaving the same harbor in August 1492 as Columbus and the three ships on their way to the Americas. That happened literally in the same week, and both in terms of when you think of superiority, inferiority, etc. Jack?
I find there's a problem in equating imperialism with racism or with white supremacy. I don't think it's necessary to do that. It seems to me that racism, it can be and often is an aspect, but it isn't the whole ball of wax. It's a strain to put it in that direction, and you just lose some people around the room in understanding and dealing well with imperialism by doing that. And the thought that comes to my mind is that I do not believe American imperialism is limited to, for example, American economic imperialism goes out to Europe. We're colorblind. I mean, the idea is that imperialism is exploiting other peoples for self-gain. That's what it's about. And it can include race, it can include ethnicity, and it can include many other things. And I think for her to make racism the entire ball of wax is to distort the argument and meet her own needs, I guess, in terms of what she wants to say. I just wanted to add one additional point onto that, and that is when she says that the exploitation of Indians, or Native Americans, and the Holocaust regarding Native Americans is the foundation on which all further American imperialism exists and builds upon. I don't think that's true. I think it happened, but then at a later point, other reasons and other bases and other conditions of imperialism, and as a matter of fact, I don't think it's that Americans remembered the Indian experience and built from it. I think as a matter of fact, amnesia is the main aspect of the treatment of American Indians. You rarely hear anyone really owning up, speaking of, or making relevant in any way the existence of what happened with Native Americans. So I do not at all believe it builds on it. So I have a feeling that this argument throws us off rather than helps us in proceeding with our discussion.
Well, I think, again, the focus... Remember, the focus is on the United States, but at the same time, what you said about imperialism not having to be what we would, when we think of racially based, as in white on black, etc., the English, who are Caucasian, had no problem oppressing the Irish, who are also Caucasian, though, of course, the Irish were thought of as a savage race. And earlier in European history, Western Europeans had no problem exploiting those in Eastern Europe, the Slavs, the slaves. And so in that sense, in terms of some of the other arguments that other authors in the Monthly Review would make, following your argument, is that if there were no quote-unquote racial differences in the world, imperialists would still not have a problem exploiting people, because it is ultimately about resources and power. And so everybody could be all white or all black or whatever, and the issue would still be that struggle.
Well, I really thought it was one of the best articles I've ever read. I think that it's true that the originalities of the whole thing was started off as against people because of their religion or because of their lack of Christianity. And I've heard it mentioned before, when the Crusades was done, yeah, they went in there for conquering the Holy Land to bring the word of Jesus, but when it came down to it, it was the land and it was the gold and it was all the other things, that the racial, the religious, all was a secondary thing. The majority of the of U.S. imperialism, of colonial and eventually U.S. imperialism, has been oriented towards racism. Vast majority of it has been oriented towards racism. And even the Civil War, the northern industrialists were not pro-black or wanted to free the black man. Basically, they wanted to get rid of, it was a conflict between two social systems. And it was to get rid of the social system that did have slavery, but it was basically to enslave both the blacks and the whites of the South. But they were the ones in back of the Klan originally after the Civil War. Things I've always thought was interesting, though, was that when Christianity came to Europe, Europeans were practicing Druidism, the Wicca, the nature religions that was basically exterminated by the Christians in various ways, co-opting and so on and so forth. But then when they came to the New World, and when they went down to Africa, they found that the people were basically worshiping the same type of religions. And they used that as a basis of conquering, besides the racial question. So, it was various things. If they had been white, they would have been conquered too, there was no doubt. And white workers had always had problems and things of that nature. But the primary focus of U.S. imperialism has been against peoples of color. It may have originated with English and the Irish and Spain and things of that nature, but the main focus has been on peoples of colors, because they were the ones that owned everything when we got here, when the Europeans got here. They were the ones that owned everything. And then we brought even more of non-white people in for their labor. So,
I want to say that I'm a communist, but I can't disagree more with what some people here were saying. I agree with what you said. And Charles, you really said something very coherently that I can't try to say incoherently. I appreciate your comment very much on focusing the logic of it. When I was in school, I didn't pay much attention. But as little attention as I paid, the three things that I remember about American history was, one, taxation without representation, and independence, and so forth and so on. But no one hid the fact that we killed a whole bunch of Indians, and no one hid the fact that we had slavery. None of that was not discussed. That was all discussed. Those three things I remember. And the only reason that I could swallow, or anyone could swallow, the idea that the Founding Fathers had anything to do with liberty was to have a racist mindset. If you have a racist mindset, or if you're in a racist country, then you can't talk enough about racism. You can't say that this is too focused on racism. You could say, well, even if the first Americans were white, we would have conquered them anyway. That's irrelevant, because the history of the world overwhelmingly is Europeans conquering, killing, slaughtering, mutilating, raping non-Europeans. You can't emphasize it enough. And I don't think, like I said, if everyone was white, then we'd still kill each other. That's irrelevant to me. It's really irrelevant to me because of what you say, or that's what our history is. That's what it will continue to be. I work with every race in the world, and they're all racist against each other still. I hear it every day. And it's not up to, it's not up to white Americans or white Europeans to decide when something is racist, when racism is relevant or irrelevant. We don't get to figure that out. It has to be pointed out to us by others. We don't decide, well, this argument is not relevant enough, or this is skewed, or this is, because we're blind. We're blind. I'm racist now. I've been trying for 50 years not to be, but I still am. And I don't get to pick and choose when to ignore racism.
By the way, for those in the room who want a more political economy analysis of imperialism, make sure you come back next month for John Bellamy Foster's article, one of the editors of Monthly Review. But again, her focus is on what is now the U.S. And to piggyback these comments, especially with Jim raised, essentially, the argument that you can't understand the nature of U.S. imperialism without confronting what we might call racism or white supremacy first vis-a-vis the indigenous first Americans who were here. It's not that the United States is not engaged in wars against other white people, try World War I and World War II, but overwhelmingly in terms of imperial wars from the beginning, from 1776, with the Tripoli pirates in what is now Libya under Jefferson, and especially if you go through post-Civil War, the little Dagos, as Teddy Roosevelt called the Cubans, but the Filipinos and the Nicaraguans and the Haitians and the Dominicans and the Cubans again and the Vietnamese and the Koreans, and the terms, if you read the history of the Vietnam War carefully, some of the terms were used, Indian names were used for some of the missions in Vietnam, and it was Indian country. And think of even some of the implements, the famous Apache helicopter. And little things that I'm sure when we're growing up, I mean, who the hell knew that the Winnebago that you saw on the road, that was the name of a people, okay? That's an Indian nation. So the wars against people that sometimes defined as non-white or people of color, I think she's arguing that in terms of this history, it's absolutely critical. And I think if you then put it together with a more recent history, when you look at Bellamy Foster and some of Williams, that you then get that connection with resources and racism, that it's a class and race empire. And in this society, from the beginning, as I said, from Plymouth Rock on, and we all did our little Thanksgiving thing in schools, where I went to school in Brooklyn and Rochester, not the only place they had those Thanksgiving little charades. So, but a lot of the other history we just didn't know, so we couldn't make any judgment. Woody? Yeah.
Well, by the time the mic has gotten to me here, a lot of people have said what I wanted to say, but I guess I'm going to say that, yes, it seems like that it's always mixed up with race and economics, et cetera, et cetera. I guess I'll try to ask a question. It seems like all through history there's always a few people like us, people that try to figure these things out, or, you know, like the abolitionists, for example. You know, you could probably go back to ancient Greece, and there's a small group of people who were maybe more conscious of the, you know, we think we're a great democracy here, you know, with Socrates and Plato and this and that and the other, but look who we oppress. I was watching the TV last night where Kronos, which was this great civilization on Crete, which got wiped out by tsunamis and an earthquake, as soon as that happened, the Egyptians that were giving them help, but the Greeks said, oh, these guys are in a weak position. They went and overtook them. Took their land and killed them, you know, and stuff. I mean, there's always sort of an elite on the other hand, you know, but besides the people that are enlightened or maybe trying to change things or understand what's wrong, you know, like the abolitionists, there's always this elite that's doing things, you know, like the neocons and the Bush regime right now. There's always some group like that. And I guess my question is, the rest of the people, you know, the unwashed masses, so to speak, 90% of the people, if you interview them, they believe all kinds of weird things. You know, we don't have enough education, enough, you know, educational programs or this, that, or the other, because people just believe all kinds of things. And back in those days in the U.S., they really did believe the Indians were pagans or witch. You know, they were hanging witches. And if we want to talk about South America as well as North America, the Catholics persecuted and butchered people in South America. And Isabella and, you know, Columbus wanted to get gold and... Well, they believed they had a mission to bring Catholicism around the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it always seems to be like that. I mean, even now, all these people, the right-wing Christians right now have a video game which they give to kids, which has, when Armageddon comes and the rapture happens,
oh, yeah,
they're given tactical weapons to shoot everybody who's a non-believer. They have this game has them killing everybody else that's not a Christian, that's not converted to Christianity.
But see, you have to root that in order, I mean, part of her argument, part of the argument I'm going to be making month after month till it drives you nuts, is that in order to understand what may seem to be, to some of us, the enlightened, how people can believe these bizarre things or believe that the Bible told me so and therefore we can persecute these people and so on. You're right. You then have to go back in history to see that these kind of attitudes, which people might say, my God, this is the 21st century, yet the attitudes about various races of people, the attitudes on the basis of sexual orientation, can be rooted and understood when you go back. It reads what Cotton Mather and others said and what people wrote about the Pequot and other Native American nations at that time in Massachusetts and upstate New York, etc., that it was very incredibly deep in the bloodstream, and we internalize that. It's a social process. As I said, I'm starting from the assumption that, you know, when you look at infant children, you look at innocent children, they have not internalized that notion of hatred. And yet that has to be internalized from the elite on down, because otherwise, and the motives, by the way, the sincerity is there. People did believe as L. Frank Baum did. They deeply, sincerely, totally, genuinely believe that these people should be slaughtered, which is why I would always suggest to never question people's motivation. I mean, they never question their sincerity. When they tell you we ought to string these people up, that's what they mean. And it was brought home again for some of you. One of the PBS stations is running one of the really magnificent things that PBS has done is Eyes on the Prize, the history of the civil rights movement. And you hear some of that cracker stuff from the South about our niggers and colored people and they're not going to do this and that, and so we got to kill them. Well, that was internalized, and somehow we have to understand what is it about those ideologies, because that then provides the basis to be able to go out and kill someone, I believe.
I'm beginning to believe that no matter how many laws you pass against discrimination, that it's just below the surface. If you look at recent times, you'll see some of the largest demonstrations this country's ever seen, with like a 500,000 or 1 million in Chicago, in the Los Angeles, Mexican people demonstrating. It seems like it's easy to bring this out in people. And you'll even see, I mean, things I never thought I'd hear. I went to an FCC hearing recently. There was a Mexican school that got bomb threats because of hate radio. It's ABC, it's Disney.
Why are you shocked given the history of the
country? Because I didn't think you could put that stuff on the airwaves. I thought there was a law against it, and it seems like at one time there was.
There were laws from the early part of the United States as a country against killing people.
I didn't think you could use radio.
Well, I'm trying to get this back to her argument to see how this links up with centuries of what we've learned about Mexicans, Cayuga, etc., etc.
Well, I'm sure it's sort of job-oriented, too. I mean, some people see themselves out of work, and they figure their job went to Mexico. But still, I don't think it'll ever disappear. I don't think racism will ever disappear, no matter how many laws you pass. It just surprises me.
Well, for a while at least, we're going to try and avoid what's going to happen in the future in order to get a grounding about what's happened in the past. Are you holding the mic there?
I'm holding the mic, yes. Actually, this article or this essay ties in very nicely with the economic aspects of imperialism, because when you are imperialist and you exploit, you can't just say we are going to exploit. You have to have some justifications, and this basically, to me at least, talks about how you justify exploiting others. Because not everybody in an imperial society benefits from imperialism, right? So there's a group of people who benefit, but they cannot say to others who have to make certain sacrifices that you have to follow these imperial policies. So I found it very, very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a what's called sort of a justifying ideology. We might call it a rationalization, because clearly if to the core of our being we felt this was wrong and what was happening to blacks in the South in the 50s and the 60s or what was happening to the Cayuga in the 1770s, if that aroused such an absolute antipathy among white people, then General Sullivan, and if it aroused his troops who were doing the killing and the marauding, then you cannot do it. You cannot do it. So part of the whole thing, especially, and it's very powerful and very difficult at times to understand in a society like this, is how generation after generation we have been imbued with this dominant ideology that allows us to continually to see, especially people of color, in this way, so that then you can exploit them. And then later, some of us learn enough about what went on, and one of the tragedies is we have to always keep reinventing the wheel because we don't take the analysis from upstate New York in 1770 and just move it to Mexico in 1848 and then move it to Vietnam in 1965. And so we have to continue to say, oh, gee, we've never done this before. Have we ever done this before? And that's part of what she's getting at, that essentially if you close your eyes and you throw a dart on a map, we've been there before and we've done that before. And if we don't learn that, then there's nothing, absolutely nothing we're going to understand about Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, or anything else.
I just want to say that I think she does a really good job of maintaining the connection between race and class. And she says right here, what we witness in the late 15th and early 16th century Spain is the first instance of class leveling based on imagined biological racial differences. Indeed, the origin of white supremacy, the necessary ideology of colonial projects in America and Africa. It's imperative to demonize the people who are different from the imperialists. Okay, the axis of evil. All the people who are different from George Bush, you know, must be done with. You see demonizing with all kinds of groups of people. In Germany with the Jews, with homosexuals. It's a necessary ingredient of imperialism, and it cannot be disconnected.
About 10, 15 minutes ago, you said that the overwhelming consensus in America 150 years ago was to wipe out the Indians. Is that correct, basically?
No, I wouldn't say overwhelming consensus because, in fact, even in the, certainly in the Senate, I mean, there was real debate around the Indian removal bill. Mm-hmm. I mean, there clearly were people in the country who were deeply disturbed by these kinds of policies.
But didn't you say that the prevailing notion was to get rid of
Indians? Oh, yeah, the prevailing. I mean, I would say the dominant ideology in terms of looking at American Indians, Native Americans, was one of people looking at others in a superior, inferior way. They were in the way of Western expansion. They had to be removed. And they were removed. Remember the civilized tribes, and we were during the break trying to figure out which of those five civilized tribes, and we could only come up with the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Cree, perhaps, and the Cherokee, and I honestly don't know the other one. They were removed and sent to what then became the Indian Territory, but then, of course, they opened up, and then it became Oklahoma, and opened up that Indian Territory to landholders who just roared in, and then they moved them again.
I'm just wondering what stops us short from committing genocide against the Indians. Today I ask a lot of Jewish friends, you know, a lot of people who are staunchly pro-Israel, well, why don't you just commit genocide against us Palestinians and get rid of the problem? And you can't get a straight answer out of them.
Well, Ward Churchill, in one of his books, lays out, actually, I think there's seven different aspects in the Genocide Convention that was passed by the United Nations. Genocide does not mean solely the total elimination or extermination of a people. It also has other elements in terms of an assault on their culture, the denial of economic rights, etc., etc. So as a people, American Indians were not totally exterminated, though in Stannard's book, he says, for example, that, you know, there are different estimates by historians, anywhere from 6 or 7 million up to 20 million indigenous people north of the Rio Grande in what is now the United States and Canada. And in terms of the continental United States, that dropped to 250,000 by 1890. It's now back up to, I think, about 2+ million. But Churchill and others would argue that the policies in terms of physical assault, wars, disease, assault on culture, boarding schools were genocidal overall, even though the last single person was not eliminated physically from the earth. And a number of people would argue in terms of some of the policies of Israel toward the Palestinians, one would argue the same way. It does not mean you literally exterminate a people. And I can't quote all of the different parts of that UN convention, because in our image I grew up with, genocide means you just kill everybody. That's not how the United Nations defines genocide.
Well, then genocide has been committed against the American Indian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When you add all the loss of land base, the loss of millions of buffalo in the plains, where thousands upon thousands of white Americans would go out on trains and other implements and just have weekend parties and just shoot thousands of buffalo and leave them rotting there. Now, in terms of the sense of land and in terms of the sense of the necessity of buffalo for the livelihood of Native American people, in terms of their conceptions of reality, that could never happen because they'd be committing suicide. And they would not do that. Yet that 20 million, 30 million, who knows how many buffalo were literally slaughtered in what is now the Plains State. So it was genocidal. But Jack's comment before, but you hear very little about this in terms of that history, that amnesia, you know, remembrance. You know, because if we forget that, I mean, some people haven't forgotten. But for the rest of us, many others, it's a luxury. We can forget. You know, I mean, hey, people say, oh, they have casinos and their people and people live in cities, etc., etc. And that whole past, many of us never had a chance to learn it. So how could we even make any judgment and be critical? It had nothing to do with our brainwaves. I mean, if it wasn't introduced to us by our parents or in the schools, forget about the mass media. I mean, I grew up in the era of 1940s and 50s films, okay? John Wayne, and Making the West Safe for White Women, and et cetera. Well, we grew up with that. Who knew about criticizing films? We were in the balcony at the Endicott Theater in Brooklyn, and we were cheering for John Wayne.
So that's a good segue to get into the cultural aspect of imperial power. And I have known people who have come here within, last say, 3 decades, and they would perceive blacks to be thieves. They would call Latinos or Mexicans, South Central and Latin America people, to be wetbacks. And those are nothing but the culture of this empire that dominates almost all of us, that we use that vocabulary, that lexicon, that we use the same language. So maybe we can spend a few minutes on how to dismantle either some aspects of it. How do we challenge this imperial power, the culture of it?
You mean whether one was raised, born here in the United States, grew up in the United States, or people coming from other countries also picking up certain ideologies?
Correct.
One of the examples was in the paper just this past week. A very large immigrant population in the Sacramento area happened to be disproportionately Russian, Eastern European, who are becoming some virulently homophobic and attacking gay people in the Sacramento Davis area. And not that I'm sure that kind of homophobia does not already exist in Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union. So it's not just that white, down-home white people who grew up here pick up that. So let me sort of throw it back to you. One, what's the process that first people internalize? I mean, what is it about coming to this culture that allows people then to sort of get into that game of we'll put other people down?
Yeah. Even? I think one aspect of it is the ones who come here, and I speak from my experience when I came here, you get a sense that you are not good. You are less than people here. And that most probably comes down to you're less than white people. Okay, they instill that in you when you're even in your own country. Because through the culture of movies and John Wayne, you mentioned, they sort of like show you the technology equivalent to you are inferior because you don't have that technology. Even though like the Aztecs had technology that they didn't need. I mean, there are computers right now that they're trying to figure out what did the Mayans and Aztecs did. And they haven't been able to figure out their technology. So they sort of like make you to think that you are others. You are not part of this. And they shrink you down to you are less than them, this imperial power, through its culture of being white or non-white or having enough money or not having enough money. Their value systems being imposed on you.
But if people of color come to what is now the United States, having been defined that way as being other, not white, and of course the old lexicon, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, what is it that then turns people who have been defined as inferior into people who then can take out that inferiority on Latinos and African Americans?
I think it's part of it to be accepted in the society. Like what we said to Japanese, they were whites after World War II. This government took it under their umbrella to rebuild their society, and they were considered to be white. What it's been tried to do, to be accepted by the white middle class folks in a financial aspect of it, not in cultural aspects or education part of it, but that's how I have seen it.
Well, the counter, because you asked the question about, I mean, how do we begin to combat this? It seems to me, again, to go to the end of my comments, that unless there's some kind of confusion or contradiction or challenge or change of consciousness, which also can be an emotional process as well, but unless there is a profoundly different way of looking at how we are defined and challenging the dominant views, then there's no way out of that dilemma. There's absolutely no way out of that dilemma, because if I internalize that about other people, about people who come from your country or whatever, I can't break that pattern. And that means I have to be exposed to some alternative views other than the dominant view.
And that's correct. That's when you start learning and teaching other cultures.
You know, a teacher, a parent, a political group, a radio station, a film, the means are many. but it's a fundamentally different way of looking at the world. And that's also, you mentioned culture, that's being battled out now in the Japanese and Japanese American community right here in Los Angeles because of Lieutenant Watanabe, who's a second lieutenant, United States Army, who's refusing to go to Iraq, and it has caused a profound conflict within the Japanese American community. Some veteran groups condemning him, some of the Vietnam veterans who were Japanese supporting him, in terms of, think of the images of Japanese and Japanese Americans being put into camps, and then some getting out of those camps in order to fight against other people of color, though the Japanese forces were used in Europe. And so that whole cultural conflict. And without any conflict, there is no change of consciousness. Unless there's a conflict, contradiction, and confusion, or I don't know what I learned, or is this true, what I've been taught about Indians? If I just swallow this and there's no one there to help me with that process, they got me.
My last point would be that we can use a different language than the dominant lexicon that it's been used to portray our beliefs and ideas. So we don't have to say the N-words. Right. You know, we don't have to say those people don't know anything. They don't have a culture. They don't understand. What we can say is that person has something that I can learn from. Till we reach that equality among individuals, we're not going to break away from this cultural domination.
Roxanne talked about the Welsh being taken over by the English even before they went into Ireland. And these are white people working on white people. The main reason they were there were for the coal and the iron. And they sold the Welsh a bill of goods saying they were superior to the Irish. And they paid them in coin of the realm, where they paid the Irish workers in cast iron coins that they made in the factory. So it shows just how creative the imperial imperative is and can be. And if we look to the economics, I think we will be able to cover any of the cultural aspects, because the economics are always at the base of it, and the flexibility is in the cultural aspect.
One of the things that Dunbar Ortiz did not talk about, and of the individuals who were taught that they were less than or treated as less than and somehow internalized that, and yet they come to a point where they then do to others what was done to them. What hasn't been talked about is the psychological aspect and the defense mechanism of identifying with the aggressor, which is one of the ways that people deal with having been treated inferior. And we talk about how do we break this thing of the racism, the imperialism, all these things we've been talking about. And I think that is a part of the problem, is this psychological component of identification with the aggressor that happens, that's different from the racism and all the rest. It's a psychological thing that happens.
It gets internalized very, very deep, and to the point where basically you carry around the police or the dominant group in your head, so nobody has to hit you. Again, to go back to Eyes on the Prize, that series, you see how that process is struggled with and how people begin to rise up and empower themselves by acting on the oppression and the definition of their lives as being inferior, especially in the examples in last night's segment of Mississippi, which was as barbaric a place in the continental United States as existed in the 20th century. And this was the 1960s, okay? And Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, et cetera, and going back to the 50s with Emmett Till, and how people were kept down and broke through that, and resisted that. So thank you, and I'll see you next month. And actually hook the Foster and Dunbar Ortiz articles together, and you sort of have the racial class analysis down pat.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.